Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Robin Lamont. Thanks for being with us, Robin.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Hi, Robin. Can we start out by having you tell our listeners how you got involved in animal activism?
Yeah. I was actually sort of introduced to animal activism by my husband, who has always been a vegetarian and vegan for a number of years. And he introduced me to the notion of what is going on for farm animals. As I turned my efforts as a suspense novelist to creating a suspense thriller series that centered around a group of investigators who were exposing animal cruelty and industrialized animal cruelty, I began researching other areas of what was going on in the world for animals. And the more I learned, the more I decided I need to speak up for the animal.
Well, that's great. I think that's something that we've all thought about on our path to veganism and animal activism. Sometimes you just look around and you think, how can people treat animals like they do in so many different ways during our lives, how we can impact them? And most of the time it's negatively, unfortunately.
Yes, well, you know, I think we all of us have, you know, love animals, but to be aware of really what's going on in different facets of the world, I think it's really important.
I think it's great that you're writing fictionalized versions of activities at slaughterhouses and what we do to wildlife, because it captures a new audience that usually shies away from fact-based reports about animal torture.
I agree. I'm a big believer that stories have an emotional power that engage people and really draw them in, allowing them to see things in a really different way. You know, when a reader steps into a character's shoes, they're brought on their own journey. And I believe they have a lot more power than just learning about what's happening through facts and figures.
Yeah, especially because, you know, large facts and figures, if people talk about, you know, 50,000 chicks, you know, something being thrown into a barrel, or the males being thrown into a barrel because they're not viable or they're not profitable for the egg industry. You know, the number is just too big for people to comprehend. But if you just walk through the steps of one person and their experiences with, if one chick, for instance, somehow that changes things drastically for some.
It does. And I think that it's not just, you know, a belief, but researchers are finding more and more that our brains as humans are wired for story. I mean, that's what creates something that stays in our memory and stays in our emotions and eventually creates behavioral change.
This is your latest book, The Trap, the second in a series called the Kinship series. The first book, The Chain, dealt with slaughterhouse issues and factory farming. And now The Trap deals with what we do to wildlife. Can you give us a brief outline without giving away anything?
Sure. Well, because it is a suspense thriller, I do tend to follow the genre. And in this book, one of my investigators is looking at wolves in the wild, you know, something she's always wanted to see. And she suddenly learns that a wildlife trapper has been murdered, caught in his own leg hold trap, and the main suspect is an ALF member.
Animal Liberation Front.
Animal Liberation Front, and a man that she knows quite well. So her search for the killer takes her undercover in Idaho, where she finds out about wildlife services.
Just following up on the wildlife services, some of our listeners, although I mentioned it briefly in our news item today, a lot of people, from the name of it, it sounds like an organization that would help wildlife.
Yeah.
So let's just make sure that all of our listeners know what Wildlife Services really does. And Robin, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah. Wildlife Services is a branch of the USDA, and their stated mission is to help humans and wildlife coexist. But in practice, it's quite an opaque agency that responds directly to ranchers and private interests that clash with wildlife. They do a great deal of what they call animal dispersal, particularly with birds around airports to keep planes and birds from colliding and causing problems. But quite a lot of what they do is outright killing of animals, and that's particularly true when it comes to predators, natural predators like bears, wolves, and coyotes.
Well, and the agency kills just millions of animals a year. Like you said, a good number of them are birds, but some of the birds aren't causing problems at airports. Maybe they're just having large roosting populations that are causing people in urban areas to be uncomfortable with noisy birds in the morning or bird poop or whatever. The Wildlife Services used to have the name Animal Damage Control, which kind of tells a little clearer picture of what their role really was. If people complain that animals are a nuisance, this is the agency that comes in and outright removes them through lethal means and often brutal lethal means.
That's really true. I think the average is, at least what they report, is about 4 million animals a year.
Well, I've seen figures that it's at least double that, that they disperse poisons, that there's a lot of unintentional killing going on, including companion animals.
Well, that was the thing that shocked me the most when I started researching Wildlife Services, is that as a federal agency, they are permitted to use the kinds of killing methods that even the state agencies are not allowed to use. For instance, they can do aerial gunning from the air, shooting wolves and coyotes from an airplane, and they use something called M44s, which are cyanide capsules dug into the ground in little traps. And when the predator or animal bites onto the trap, it releases cyanide gas up into the animal's mouth. Wildlife Services claim the death comes within minutes, but all reports indicate from people who have seen it that this is not true, and it is a painful and slow death for any animal that bites.
A couple of years ago, the Sacramento Bee in California did a series of reports on Wildlife Services, and they brought to light a number of things about companion animals, how it is standard practice in Wildlife Services to cover up the killing of dogs and cats.
Absolutely. I mean, traps, by their very nature, are indiscriminate. They are baited with animal remains, and they will attract many animals. They don't have signs on them that say, coyotes only, please. They bait and attract all sorts of animals. So it actually makes a great deal of sense that non-target animals are routinely caught in these traps. Yes, Tom Knutson, in his wonderful SACBEE expose, interviewed a number of Wildlife Services ex-employees who said that often, in their experience, the number was sometimes 2 or 3 to 1 non-target animals killed for every target animal that was meant to be taken by the trap. Huge number, just huge. And these non-target animals are not routinely reported.
On their website of Wildlife Services, they have to list all the animals that they've killed, and it's a very dark page to read. Obviously, you know, they're not reporting all the kills. It just goes on for pages and pages.
It does, and it doesn't, you know, it makes absolutely no sense when they report, you know, thousands and thousands of animals killed by traps. The whistleblowers say the non-target animals are double or triple that, and yet their numbers that they report of non-target animals killed are paltry compared to what the target animals that they report are taken.
And they kill endangered and threatened species, and there's nothing done about that.
And not only endangered species, but domestic pets.
Yeah.
Yes, right here in my own neighborhood in the Hudson Valley, New York, a dog was taken in a lake hole trapped in a public park.
Jeez. They only have to be a few meters off the public trails. Isn't that correct? I think it's something like 25 meters off of a public trail, or it's a very short distance.
It is. I think each state has their own regulations. But as I mentioned, Wildlife Services is not operated by each individual state regulations. They basically operate by their own rules. And there are stories of whistleblower intimidation and hiding evidence, so that when a domestic dog or a pet is caught, there are reports Wildlife Service agents go back into the area and quickly pick up all the traps so that they can't be accused of not labeling them or posting warnings.
It's a very an agency that continues to receive complete funding, and I guess it's due to pressure from the livestock lobby, which is another good reason not to, you know, consume beef or sheep or these other animal products that are contributing to the justification of this type of an agency.
Yeah, that's very true. And what I also learned in researching the book is that private ranchers are big funders to the state and local governments who allow Wildlife Services to come in and operate. And indeed, Wildlife Services not only is paid by federal taxpayer money, but they contract privately with ranchers and hunting organizations.
One of the big movements now is the locavore, and everyone's, oh, it's organic grass-fed beef, and somehow people feel better about that. They, you know, they don't mind that the cow is killed for that, but it's still contributing to the problem of Wildlife Services trapping and killing all sorts of wildlife. No matter how you try and package your food to make it sound better, there's still so many animals that are being affected.
There are, and you know, I feel particularly for the wolves and the coyotes, who are targeted as being the real problem in terms of predation on the livestock that is grass-fed. But in fact, if you really look at the USDA numbers, it's a very small percentage. The vast majority of livestock loss is due to weather, birth complications, and respiratory illness. Wolves are a tiny fraction of the loss of livestock.
Right, and there's so many other ways. I know in the past we had Camilla Fox from Project Coyote on, and that was one of the things we talked about, is there's so many alternate ways to find solutions for letting the animals coexist, the cattle and the wildlife.
Yes, that's very true. But the problem with that is the non-lethal methods, such as, you know, having more herders there, guard dogs, guard llamas even, it's more expensive, and it would increase the price of meat. And that, I'm afraid, most Americans won't tolerate.
Well, and it's already so highly subsidized anyway. You know, that's another issue that we could spend hours talking about.
Yeah.
But coming back to your book, so when you were researching the trap, did you actually meet and interview people from Wildlife Services, or were they receptive to meeting with you, or how did you do your research on them?
Well, I didn't speak directly to any Wildlife Services agents, but I did work very closely with Predator Defense and with Tom Knudsen, who wrote the expose. So I got a lot of what the whistleblowers were saying direct from the people who had interviewed them.
Well, what's the third novel in the Kinship series going to concern itself with?
Well, I'm just beginning on that. It's untitled as of yet, but because my literary bent is in David and Goliath stories. Here, the next book, The Kinship Investigators, will take on a major agricultural biotech company and their testing of a new herbicide on animals in the laboratory.
How do you go about deciding how to set up your research for your plots? Can you tell us how you go about framing a novel like that?
Well, you know, each book has sort of come to me in different ways. For the first book, The Chain, I had read Gail Eisenet's book, Slaughterhouse, which in itself reads a little bit like a suspense novel, with her investigations and talking to people in slaughterhouse towns. And for The Trap, I had read Tom Knutson's expose, which itself reads like a thriller. So the story sort of germinated from those readings. And again, you know, because I'm looking for stories where there is a big corporation or entity that is very powerful. And usually the powerful entities are run by greed, pursuit of profits, inertia, like a government agency, and how to expose what they're doing and the effect basically on animals.
Well, on animals and on the human psyche. I think that's one thing in your book, The Trap. You know, you saw how animal activists, you know, had to come to terms that she sort of liked the person that, in some ways, that she was dealing with.
Well, yes, I think so. I mean, people I don't believe are all bad. I don't believe that.
Well, some of them are.
maybe a few. And I think a lot of people do care about animals, but they become blind because they have outside pressures on themselves or cultural pressures. For instance, I look at trapping itself, and if you look at the history of trapping, it has a very long history in the United States. You know, the U.S., the expansion of the West, and fur trapping was the basic economic driver for the United States. And I think because of that, there has become this entrenched kind of cultural mindset that trapping animals is not only, you know, okay, it's good. It serves a vital purpose. It is an American thing. And as such, why would you even question that? So there's so many aspects to what happens to animals, but I think when you look at cultural mindsets, you often kind of dig into how they got there and the long road we have to change that.
Yeah, it can be really daunting, and it seems like the key to bring about any change is through consumer choices.
Yes, I absolutely agree.
We've been talking with Robin Lamont, animal advocate and novelist, author of her newest book, The Trap. Robin, can you tell our listeners where they can find out more about your works?
Oh, thanks. Yes, well, you can find out more about the work on my website, which is www.thekinshipseries.com. The books are on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, hardcover or print, and Kindle. Most search engines will bring it up.
It is a good read. I encourage all our listeners to go there. Thanks, Robin.
Oh, thank you.